This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's Friday. It is both sunny and cloudy, would you say, Dr. George?
Yes, indeed. Very unusual.
Yes, and that voice you're hearing is, of course, our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consulting urologist. Back, as always, to discuss, well, this time, broken hearts. Is this, you know, kind of an area you're comfortable with?
Well, you know, I'm not too comfortable with that. That's why every week we have somebody who's really expert in this area. I must clarify, we're talking about broken heart, H-E-A-R-T, rather than H-A-R-D, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, very important, because of your specialty, we need to say that.
So before everyone starts phoning in about broken heart, so please do, we're really talking about the real heart.
Yeah. And in keeping with that, we have Dr. Benny Roussani, a cardiologist from Institute Jantung Negara, IJN, and we have you in because we're talking about vitamin D specifically and how that might help people with diseased hearts. Dr. Benny, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lin. Thank you for having me here.
I kind of flagged up that we'll be opening up the phone lines because we always do for this show. And I wanted to hear from everybody about what you might have going on in terms of your heart health. You know, what have you heard is good for you? What are you personally doing? And we did actually have a question come right in from a listener who says, I've heard from a doctor that strong garlic pills reduce blood pressure. Dr. Benny, you want to weigh in?
That's the first time I heard about it, actually. I think there's no really a real heart scientific evidence to support the use of garlic peel in maintaining heart health. Mm. I would consider, you know, just a healthy lifestyles, exercise, quit smoking, and all those stuff would probably help better than garlic peels.
Well, a lot of people kind of consider, like, you know, garlic as these antioxidants. Of course, you know,
perfect food.
That's right. Right. Okay, now I see where you're coming from.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah. Do you think it has some evidence of that? I mean, I'm sure later on everybody is kind of come in to ask about Q10 and then ask about, you know, fish oil and that sort of things.
Because coconut oil.
Yeah, you know, we are going to be completely, you know, getting huge influx of everyone asking about things like that.
Yeah.
In that viewpoint, do you think, well, apart from garlic pills, is probably going to put off your friends so that you don't get to have too much excitement in life that will be too strenuous for your heart?
Yeah.
Do you think garlic actually is a myth, or it truly has got these function that will protect us and especially the heart?
All right. Well, you know what? We both went to medical schools, and back in medical schools, they all taught us about this basic research and how this research come with, you know, recommendations and guidelines on how to treat disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, coming back to garlics, all those things that you can find in the kitchen that can possibly help you with heart disease, I don't find any real evidence to support that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really recommend that to my patients on a day-to-day practice. But, you know, some people will argue that, you know, times and times, people would say that, you know, this tips from the old wives' tales and say that this helped and that helped. Well, as long as it doesn't have any immediate harm to people and they take it at a moderate consumption, not overdosing it, I don't have any qualms of actually preventing them from taking it.
It might actually reduce their stress to, you know, be able to take it and tell all these people who are bugging them to take it, I'm taking it, you know, leave me alone.
Yep. Technically, placebo effect.
Yeah.
In some ways, I mean, at least you no longer have to deal with your mom or your aunt or, you know, everybody just throwing garlic pills at you and saying, eat it, you know, just
and
eat
as
it.
Long as, like, probably, like, you know, they're also on hospital medicine, as long as they don't stop taking this medication, I'm fine with that.
Or the medicine might interact with other medicine, right?
Yeah,
okay, only
the
supplement might interact.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of doctors probably will call in because there's certain Chinese medicine will interact with a lot of drugs that you give out. Like, for example, warfarin is notoriously, you know, prone to interaction. Isn't that correct?
Exactly true. Yeah. And the other thing that I have came across in my previous, 15 years of practice, I've seen people who've been taking things like Misa Kucheng, all these, these herbs, and, you know, they actually plant it themselves and they end up with some kidney failure.
Mm.
So it's quite scary.
It is indeed. I mean, early on, I like the way you say that, you know, at the end of the day, 21st century, we really need evidence-based medicine. I mean, what you're saying that, you know, we have four levels of evidence. And, you know, the most robust evidence perhaps is a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. Exactly. And a lot of what we're describing here is anecdotal. So later on, it'll be interesting to see whether we are looking at how robust this calcium or a vitamin D story in protecting your heart.
Precisely, because this vitamin D story, it came about through a study that was conducted by researchers from the University of Leeds and Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal of the American College of Cardiology, so it's, you know, all
respectable.
There. Yes. Yeah. And what they found is that vitamin D supplements might help people with diseased hearts, but it did not result in better exercise capability. Dr. Benny, vitamin D?
Right. Well, actually, it's not just a supplement. It's at a higher dose than the natural supplement we find in the pharmacy. If I'm not mistaken, I have yet to read the full article of that journal, but what they have given to their patients is a higher dose of vitamin D.
Yes.
At about of a 100 micrograms.
Right.
Yep. As opposed to the standard supplement level that we find in, you know, in those
like
bottles
the one
that we find
in pharmacies, you get
them
in health shops.
It's about 400 micrograms.
Right. So it's about three times
higher. And plus, we need to be aware that the people that are included in this study are those who have heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
Not for every. Not for
general public.
Not for you and me.
Oh, right.
Basically for people who have been diagnosed with heart failure.
You don't know I had no heart failure.
I don't think you have, George.
Why would you say that about yourself?
No, okay, right.
You look pretty fine to me.
Yeah. How does this help you?
That's right, okay. No, just so, actually, interestingly asked this question because, you know, I suggest that we should go through this paper because I actually had a patient turning up with this paper because, as you know, I'm a urologist and I see patients who presented with erectile dysfunction. Mm. And then, you know, in our sayings, it's like, you know, the broken heart is, you know, the erectile dysfunction is possibly a early sign of broken heart, right? Okay. So because there are a lot of comorbidities such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, you know, stress, smoking, that actually will cause perhaps erectile dysfunction first before they present with heart problems such as heart attacks and eventually may lead to heart failure. So the patient turn up with this paper and say, "Doc, does that mean that from now on I take more calcium that I can actually protect my heart and can I reverse my erectile dysfunction?" Then first thing I thought about was Dr. Benny will be able to help me to answer that question.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as telling them that it actually can cure their erectile dysfunction because that is not the question that was asked by the research in the first place.
Right, okay.
Right. So what they're looking at is to use vitamin D as a supplement to improve the well-being or the quality of life for people with established heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not just people with mild heart failure. These are the ones that actually have breathlessness at rest or minimal exertion. And they have also included a unique investigation tool, what we call an echocardiogram. So in this study, they have included those with an ejection fraction. It's just basically a measurement of how good the heart pumps blood outside, with every heartbeat, and this actually has been specifically measured less than 40%. So some people with heart failure may not have an ejection fraction of less than 40%. So and again, we cannot extrapolate too much from these findings because, you know, I think as we're probably aware that the patient that was included is quite small.
Right, okay.
In size. Yeah.
So small study, short follow-up. You know, I think we've got some phone calls, is that
right? We do, and I think it's important to talk about the source of the vitamin D because, as you point out, it's in a higher dosage. I think people think vitamin D, where can I get it?
Yeah.
You know, you pop by the pharmacy, or maybe you think even, I'll just go out into the sun. And on that note, LTY has a question. Good afternoon, LTY.
Good afternoon, Lynn. Good afternoon, Dr. George.
Oh, good afternoon,
and
LTY.
Good afternoon, Dr. Gani.
Dr. Benny.
It's Benny, yeah.
Hey, how are you all? Okay.
Very good.
Now, I have two questions, all right. Now, regarding vitamin D, Since I was born, I never take any vitamin D. You know why? I take enough good cholesterol. I go under the sun for 20 minutes in the morning. Most of the cholesterol will be converted to vitamin D. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's your second question?
So far, I haven't taken any vitamin D. There's no necessity. In fact, if you take a supplement, at the end, it will harm you because most of it will be end up as metabolite, and you may have more bladder problem for Dr. Josh. Okay?
Yeah, that's right.
My second question is potassium. This is very important for cardio. All right. Now, according to this is a subject I brought up with dietitian. The amount of potassium we should consume, according to NIH, it should be around 4,700 mg. I think most of us are not getting that number.
Yeah.
But I do. I target it. I do get. The one important thing for potassium is conductivity of the heart muscle, as well as for your kidney, right, Dr. Joy?
Yeah, well, I heard York ask that question a few days ago to
to Mary's.
That's right.
Because potassium, very important for our muscle function.
Yeah.
That's why I don't have any muscle pain or what. I make sure I got enough potassium.
Okay.
Thank you for the call, TY.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to answer those two questions. Essentially, LTY was suggesting that cholesterol somehow can convert to calcium. Yeah, that's not quite
not
right,
really,
right?
Not
at all, right?
Not at all. Because basically the abundant vitamin D supply to our body come from sunlight. That's true.
That's right.
But that's because our skin start to synthesize.
That's right.
The vitamin D.
Yes.
And this is not as easy as that. It needs a couple of more steps for the vitamin D to become actively useful to our body.
Indeed.
Including transferring those properties to the liver and to the kidney.
That's
so
correct.
Basically, for someone to have a normal level of vitamin D in their body, mm-hmm. they have to have a functioning liver and kidney
to begin with.
It doesn't come, well, to answer that question, it doesn't come from cholesterol.
That's right. And so, LTY, you know, to consider that taking plenty of cholesterol, go into the sun, to think that cholesterol will somehow disappear, I think that is definitely wrong. Is that correct?
Sorry, come again?
You know, LTY said he eats plenty of
good cholesterol,
and then somehow go to the sun and somehow make his this all convert to calcium. It's probably wrong.
Yeah,
okay,
I agree
right.
with you. Yeah.
Definitely wrong. And the second thing he went on a little bit about potassium and say, you know, potassium, I heard you ask that question. It's like, you know, indeed, potassium in a very healthy person with healthy kidneys actually has no qualm about it. But it can be a dangerous, you know, in inverted commas, supplement, really,
right,
isn't it?
Correct,
because
correct.
You know, potassium is the lethal injection for somebody to kill off, you know, in order to get somebody's heart to stop. Isn't
exactly.
that right?
That's what they use in the U.S. prison
that's
isn't
right.
it?
This is for the lethal injection.
Yeah.
This is it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So would you like to elaborate a little bit? I mean, so obviously you see many patients presented with deranged electrolytes
right.
in the cardiology
right.
departments, right?
So usually people that have deranged in potassium or any other electrolytes are those with, well, kidney problems. They'll probably have kidney failure, and the kidney impairment would lead to increase in serum potassium. Or people who are on certain medication may have a lower level of potassium. By large, most people that presented to wellness clinic, those are healthy people, do not have problem with their serum potassium level. So we just have to be careful a little bit with people who actually taking certain types of medicines or who have certain organ abnormalities such as kidney problems. Otherwise, by large, most people don't have a problem with keeping their potassium at a normal range.
Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, what LTY said is that he aims to get enough potassium into his diet through his diet. Like, he does not...
Right. He take a supplement.
He does his best to avoid them. That's what
right.
he said on a previous show. So in such a circumstance, do we still need to worry about the overload of potassium if you're trying to get that way through, you know, the consumption of food as opposed to popping pills?
Such as bananas and mushrooms.
I think that's fine. By taking just a normal, healthy diet, you can get away by, you know, by having just a normal level of potassium.
Mm. Yeah.
We have a question here from Indra. It's not exactly to do with our show, but it has to do with the heart. So
okay. Hi, Indra. Yeah. Good afternoon.
Right. Hi. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for hosting this show. My dad had five bypasses 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, five bypasses. Is it possible to have leg swelling right now? Because he claims that the veins have been removed in order to do those five bypasses. So I was just wondering whether the current he's having swelling in the legs at the bottom half of the legs, finds it difficult to walk, And he claims that it may be because of the veins that were removed 20 years ago. So please tell me
whether... Okay, thank you, Indra, for this, the question.
Okay.
Dr. Benny will be perfect person to answer that.
This is much more comfortable than answering the potassium level.
That's right.
But yeah, thank you for the question. Usually people who have bypass, you know, surgeons, the cardiac surgeons would take conduit from either the artery inside their chest or the veins from the leg. Mm-hmm. We call it the saphenous vein graft. To graft the block vessel in the for bypass surgery,
mm-hmm.
Usually they would not lead to any significant leg swelling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the question comes in,
five bypasses,
yeah, but that's right. But anyway, for people who have leg swelling, breathlessness, you know, poor exercise tolerance, mm-hmm. I would be more concerned about the function of the heart as a whole.
That's right.
Because the person might have heart failure. As we know that people with coronary artery disease who have had bypass, and maybe after so many years, the bypass graft might not be as good as before,
mm-hmm.
It may lead to a heart failure if they don't have enough function going on. Mm.
So what advice would you have for Indra? I mean, she's right. Clearly a concerned daughter calling about her father.
Yes, exactly. I would advise Madam Indra to bring her father back to hospital and see the cardiologist. We perhaps could assess him and look at whether he has heart failure. And this is from the further clinical history taking, examination, we're doing an echocardiogram, mm-hmm. and probably if it needs to, we may need to look at the graft that has been planted.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, essentially we're going to talk a little bit about heart failure per se.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially for somebody who had a bypass so many years ago, mm-hmm. and it's like we're talking about five bypasses so many years ago, the bypasses can last only up to a point, isn't that correct?
Correct.
And then so 20 years later, there is a possibility that the heart may give way. What will happen? I mean, how many bypasses can you do?
Well, it depends on the nature of the blockage in the first place. Some people can go for two bypasses surgery,
mm-hmm.
But in most circumstances, if we were to find that there is a problem with the original graft, we could do an angioplasty,
right.
In which what we do in IGN on almost daily basis. People, first we have to do angiograms.
Mm-hmm.
Angiogram is just basically a name where we basically a procedure that we do under local anesthesia, in which we put dye through the artery, mm-hmm. or through the graft and see whether are they still patent. Now, if that say there is some blockage and technically it is feasible to open it up with a balloon, it is much more quicker, safer, rather than doing another bypass surgery,
mm-hmm.
because as we know, people who had bypass usually they're older people,
mm-hmm.
and 10 years down the line, when they need a second bypass, they become older.
Yes.
So usually we're looking at a person with probably a lower than normal reserve, cardiac function than before.
Mm. What I'm curious about here is because from the tone of Indra's call, and I'm just guessing, it sounds as if they're concerned about the swelling legs, and he is saying, it's just the bypasses from before.
No. In fact, what he's saying is that they've taken too many veins.
Exactly.
Now I end up with this.
And it's not about his current health. It's about what happened, 20 years ago. And in such a circumstance, how often do you see that kind of resistance? I'm assuming he's resistant because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like he's saying, I don't need a doctor. They took out too much to begin with. I'm not going back. So how often do you encounter that, and what would you say to someone listening who is thinking, I'm never going to a hospital again, it's fine?
Well, you can't force people to come to the hospital and see doctors.
But
even to see Dr. Josh Lee. But anyway, I think what people need, most patients need a good social support from their family. Is good is for them to have an understanding of their overall health, and what is important to them is, if let's say they are worried about any issues, is to to come forward and see doctors, because you can't leave everything being complacent about it, because the longer you wait, you know, things can get more serious.
We're talking today about heart health and heart disease specifically. How vitamin D can help, that was the beginning of our show. But we're really interested to hear from you guys. If you've got any questions about your heart health, today's a really great day to call. If you have, you know, what you think of as a silver bullet, if you've been doing something that you think is working, share. You know, sharing is caring. That number is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living, our doctor in the house. Dr. George Lee is in together with Dr. Benny Roussani, cardiologist, and we're talking about heart health, really. I mean, we opened with how vitamin D could help heart failure, but we would like to hear from you. Any questions to do with heart health today? It is an open clinic of sorts. Dr. Benny is on hand to answer your questions. We would also like to hear if you've got something aside from vitamin D, or if you are taking vitamin D, if you've been hearing people tell you things that work, please give us a call. That number, 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have Vijay on the line. Good afternoon, Vijay.
Hi, Vijay.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Just a quick question here. My brother had a triple bypass about 9 years ago. And lately, he had a bit of an episode where he had trouble breathing and was feeling very lethargic. So he went to the hospital, and I think based on some preliminary tests, they found out that his heart is functioning at 30% capacity.
Mm.
He's going to be referred now to Serdang Hospital and for more tests. My question is that normal, or would this 30% capacity would have come about immediately after his bypass, or... what can he do next?
Thanks for the question, Vijay.
Thanks, Vijay.
Okay. So, Dr. Benny, somebody 9 years after cardiac bypass, a little bit similar to Indra's dad,
yes.
Now proven decreased function of the heart. I mean, it's 9%, you know, what
30%.
Yeah. What is the critical cutoff for how many percentage when you do the echocardiogram for the, that's called ejection fraction, right?
Correct.
It's considered critical.
Well, you know, by and large, most people would have, well, there is some variation, but anything more than 50 to 70% is considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming back to what is abnormal, usually we would say less than 40% would be
considered not normal.
Considered as a heart failure.
All right.
And anything between 40 to 50 is sort of in borderline.
Right.
Yeah, because heart failure is actually a clinical diagnosis. It's more like a syndrome,
right?
Whereby you have to have symptoms, you have to have, you know,
so it's not
criteria.
Just those figures
it's
determining.
It's not just based on one parameter that derived from echocardiogram. But that 30%, our caller mentioned earlier, came from a tool, the one that I mentioned earlier, an echocardiogram, in which 30% would definitely means that the person have heart failure. Now, usually it doesn't come right about after bypass, because the purpose of doing a bypass is to improve the circulation.
That's right.
in the coronary artery. And that is mainly to prevent heart failure from happening. Now, after 9 years or 20 years, like our previous caller, we would expect there would probably be some narrowing in the graft that has been put in. So naturally, an insufficient amount of blood in the heart would lead to heart failure finally.
Right, okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's going to be referred to a tertiary center like yourself and then, you know, or another center. What can be done? I mean, is heart failure, let's say, you know, despite all the vessels are patent,
correct.
Somebody who faced with heart failure, it's a very critical condition, isn't it?
Yep, it is. Well, usually I would like to, to separate the management of heart failure into three categories. One is by, you know, just lifestyle modification. A person need to quit smoking, maybe cut down the alcohol intake if they drink, do some mild to moderate level of intensity of exercise, avoid drinking too much water, because the water that they consume will be retained in their body.
There's nowhere to go.
Right, correct. So the heart has to work harder. So usually I would advise people with people with heart failure to limit their fluid intake less than a liter a day.
Okay.
All right. And the second part is medicine. So medicine, as you mentioned earlier, the anti-cholesterol, aspirin, there are certain medication that doctors give that the purpose is to prolong life and to reduce symptoms. The third thing that could come in is device. Like, for example, CRT therapy, cardiac resynchronization therapy, that can be put to certain people with heart failure. There are certain types that actually can benefit from this, from heart failure.
Okay.
We have a question now about medication from Sheila. Good afternoon, Sheila.
Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about cholesterol-lowering medications.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's still necessary to take cholesterol-lowering medications such as, simvastatin, etc., if cholesterol level is normal. Because this is regarding my dad, so he's been diagnosed with heart disease, but no significant findings on echo or ECG. Only thing is when they did the angiogram, they detected some blocks, so they had some stents put in, but clinically, has a lot of symptoms like breathlessness, chest pain, but on test, the doctors keep insisting that everything is normal. So I'm just wondering, and even his cholesterol level is normal, so I'm wondering whether the breathlessness and all could be a side effect of the simvastatin, and whether it's okay to stop that since his cholesterol level has always been normal.
Okay, great question.
Thanks, Sheila.
I think that's a very good question. The guidelines recommendation by the American College of Cardiology and the European Society of Cardiology recommend a patient need to be on anti-cholesterol-lowering medication such as statin after an event, after a heart attack. Somebody probably would have a normal serum cholesterol, but, because if they have an event, they still need to be put on the statin, because multiple researches has been done before to show that a drug such as statin have what we call a pleiotropic effect, in which the benefit of putting them on statin extends beyond the numbers alone. So although they may have a normal cholesterol level, but statin has an anti-inflammatory effect that works to help patient.
And what about the the other symptoms that Sheila's noticing in her father, the shortness of breath and so on.
As far as we know,
could that be the...
As far as we know, that statin does not actually cause breathlessness. Some people might say that they have muscle ache, muscle pain. That is quite understandable. A lot of people might have that. What we do is, if they have the symptoms, is we probably can cut down the dose or probably change it to another type of statin.
Yeah, I mean, if Sheila wanted figures to say, versus placebo, her dad has got normal cholesterol. For him to take this, will it prolong his life?
Yes, definitely it will. That's what the research have shown anyway.
Sure. Okay.
And we know that there is no limit to how much the cholesterol can be lowered. There are some study to show that the lower, the better.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have Thong on the line. Good afternoon, Thong.
Thong.
Hi, good afternoon. Yes, I have a question. My dad is about 72, so for the past 1 year, he has been experiencing chest pain or heart pain, especially in the morning. He went to a few hospitals, IGM, all these to carry out some tests on it, and they say that there's no problem with the heart. But if there's no problem, I wonder what causes the chest pain, especially in the morning?
Another great question.
Thank
you, Tom.
Well,
incidentally, my mom has an identical question because same problem as well.
There you go.
Then I can need to ask you, sir. She went through all the tests, and her chest was, her heart was okay, her chest was okay. So what could be the cause?
Well, there are misconception out there to say that a chest pain is equivalent to heart pain, which is not. A heart is just an organ that is sitting inside our chest. But there are other things besides our heart. It could be the lung, it could be coming from the bones, the cartilage, the muscles, the ribs, So any of these things could lead to a chest pain.
Yeah.
But not necessarily coming from the heart.
Yeah.
So even people with GERD, reflux disease, can still have what we call, a reflux pain that, mostly will be felt along the chest area.
Mm-hmm.
So, somebody with a chest pain, of course, by it is important for us to rule out heart disease. So, like for me, if I have a patient in my clinic that have a chest pain, I would probably do a stress test looking at the heart. If there is no problem, there's no signs of ischemia or signs of heart disease, then we probably need to do other tests.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they might benefit from doing a scope,
endoscopy,
to look at whether they have a reflux disease, whether they have an ulcer in their stomach. And sometimes, common things happen commonly. Sometimes it's just a muscle ache, muscle pain.
I was going to say that we're seeing a theme today of women calling for their fathers, and
right.
We had, I think, three or four calls now with that being said. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, some of it was specific, like swollen legs and so on. Mm. How scared should we be, though, of something like chest pains, especially in an older man? Because you hear chest pain, you immediately think, oh no, you know, my father's going to have a heart attack, my uncle's going to have a heart attack. But how worried should we really be if someone in our life says, I seem to have chest pains?
Well, we definitely need to rule out a heart disease. And by when I say heart disease, I specifically means coronary artery disease.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people talk about heart disease, but there actually are multiple things that can go wrong with the heart. It could be the valve, it could be the coronary artery,
mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, arrhythmia problems. So we need to be quite specific in what we're talking
the
about.
The first port of call has to be you, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
Because you
just
need to establish
it.
I mean, my mom went through the cardiologist assessment. Eventually, she has got, esophageal reflux. She's got GERD. And then, you know, after taking anti-reflux medication, she was much better. I mean, of course, I want to rule that out. I mean, Lynn was asking this specific question, how worried should we be? Do you have any statistics to talk about coronary artery disease in Malaysia? Exactly how many of us kind of like eventually will face that?
I think about 20,000 people diagnosed with heart disease every year in Malaysia.
And how many of those are men? Because again,
the majority
theme is,
are men.
Right. Right. Sorry, so, you know, yeah. In what ratio? Sorry, 4-1 or 2-1 or something?
I'll say about 2-1.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the most frightening thing about women, sometimes they underplay their symptoms. Because, you know,
they are tougher.
They're too busy. They think it might be something else.
They're too busy calling about their fathers.
Yes,
that's
correct.
Why.
They're worried about somebody else, not themselves.
And
the symptoms that come with women are quite what we call atypical presentation.
Right.
Like for men, usually they have chest pain. But for women, sometimes they have backache, jaw ache, you know. Palpitation.
It's not that men are more munger, right?
No, maybe not.
Well, I think it's because the commonly thought of heart attack symptoms, we all think of, you know, the stabbing pains, the radiating, you know, things like that, and women don't. So when women have different pains, that's not the immediate thought. But we do have other calls. It's a busy show today. We have Karu on the line. Good afternoon, Karu.
Hi, Karu.
Are you still there? Okay, we might have lost Karu, but I'll ask your question anyway. Karu is on water retention pill for the heart and is curious about its side effects.
Okay, so basically, obviously something like furosemide will be the sort of, early on you talk about don't want to overload the heart with too much fluid because you need to restrict the fluid.
Yep.
And one of the ways you control this is to give the water pills. Okay,
right.
How good are these water pills? Because they all come to see me at night and say
exactly.
They pee too much. Okay, so what's going on?
Yeah. Well, the water pills or the furosemide or Lasix are very important in terms of alleviating symptoms because patients with heart failure, you know, they have breathlessness, they have fatigue, they have ankle swelling, and these are the signs to show that they have excess fluid in their body. So one of the things that this medication does is to remove this excess fluid from their body, which is good. But anyway, I need to remind all of our listeners out there that this furosemide medicine need to be taken properly according to the instruction given by their doctors because some people might need more pills than the other and some might not need to take it every day because some people may have heart failure but they don't have any excess water or they are quite compliant with their fluid intake. So excess water might not be a problem to some people with heart failure. So another thing is, as we mentioned about potassium earlier on, so people with Lasix or furosemide may lose a bit of potassium from their body. So sometimes doctor might prescribe slow K or potassium supplement to go along with this medicine just to maintain a normal level of potassium in their body.
Quite an intricate balance.
Correct.
We have other questions on the line via text, via tweets. We will get to those after this. We have the market update coming up, but our phone lines remain open. If you've got any questions on, we started off with vitamin D. You can still ask about vitamin D, but really anything at all to do with your heart health or anything that you're doing right now that you think is right or that you're worried is wrong, give us a call. That number is 03-77109000. You can also text us at 01620019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin, our doctor in the house today, Dr. George Lee. Our other doctor in the house, Dr. Benny Rusani, cardiologist. And Dr. Benny is here because we're talking about all things heart health today. And we're wanting to hear what you've been up to. What have you been doing? What have you heard that's good for you or not? Give us a call. That number 03-77109000. Text 01620019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have Ms. Chung on the line. Ms. Chung, thank you for waiting.
Hi, Ms. Chung.
we might have made Miss Chung wait too long. But she did want to ask about her son, yet again, a woman asking about a man. He underwent an angioplasty last year. Can she stop his medication now?
That's a tincture. Angioplasty last year, right? Most likely, people who undergo angioplasty, many of them who are supposed to undergo prostate operation with me, I get really worried about
the
blood thinning agents, right? Okay, would you like to elaborate a little bit about how important this is and when can they stop doing that?
Yeah, well, in general, people who have angioplasty means that they have coronary artery disease. That means blockage of the artery, and in most people who have this condition, they also have other comorbidities. Mostly people have diabetes, hypertension, and cholesterol. So basically, they need to continue these medicines for a long time. Because having an event or having a stent put in their body means that they might gonna have a recurrence in the future if they don't look after their comorbidities well.
Right.
So people who have diabetes but do not have their sugar well controlled, or they have hypertension but blood pressure not well controlled, or cholesterol but with a high serum cholesterol, that means they could have a restenosis in their artery.
Right.
And on top of that, people who have stent put in, they are required to be put on blood thinning agents or antiplatelet, what we call it, mostly aspirin, and the other one's clopidogrel.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be on this medicine generally for 1 year. And after 1 year, we might be able to stop one of the blood thinning medication. But as a whole, before you do that, come and see us first.
Because it's quite dangerous to stop it by yourself, right?
Correct, exactly.
Because it just might get blocked off.
Correct.
All right. Great question.
And on that note, a question from a listener via text. Do you believe in primary prevention with aspirin, especially for diabetics?
Another great question. Not for diabetic, for me, right? I'm not diabetic. I want to know, does that mean that if I take every day one tablet of aspirin, antiplatelets, and also what else, and high blood pressure tablets, vitamin D, am I going to live up to about 250 years old? Right.
Well, it all depends on who is the patient that asked the question. Some people may have a lot of a potential risk factor. They may have a family member who died very early on with heart disease. Mm-hmm. They may be a smoker. They may have a very sedentary lifestyle. So people who have a lot of high risk factor, aspirin as a primary prevention may help in some people. Again, there are a lot of debates out there. There are a lot of quarters that agree or disagree, and depends on which association that talks about it.
So they more agree or more disagree at the moment?
Well, I think the consensus for those people who have diabetes and certain age, maybe the more than 40 years of age, may benefit from aspirin. But again, before you do that, you have to speak to your doctor, because you may have what we call a potential harmful by taking aspirin. Some of them might have ulcer.
Of course.
So we need to consider the risk of bleeding for people who are on aspirin.
It's not exactly a completely harmless pill, really.
Exactly.
So I guess this is not, in some ways, it's not a radio question, because it's not a general question. It's a question that's specific to a patient that you see, right?
Correct.
You need to meet them, speak to them, understand their
history. We call it individualized tailored approach.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay, a bunch of questions here. I'll just get this one because I don't think we have the right doctors here. Just wondering if there's a link between vitamin D deficiency and osteoporosis. This is from Roshan.
Oh, there is, actually. Yeah, vitamin D is actually very important in the calcium as a calcium regulator, and also as a to maintain a healthy bone. So people with a deficiency in vitamin D or calcium may have osteoporosis.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially these people who are elderly. Women, people who live in,
postmenopausal,
who are not exposed to sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who are at risk of developing osteoporosis.
Mm.
So in that case, because just to clarify again, we started off talking about vitamin D, but it wasn't a preventive measure, was it? It was something that was given as a course of treatment for people with heart failure. It's a very specific moment.
Yeah.
Whereas this question is more related to what can vitamin D help to prevent?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, this article came out in April, and then, a few days ago, and the British government sort of felt that a lot of people are deficient of the calcium and vitamin D, and actually recommend vitamin D supplement for prevention in the autumn and winter months. I mean, would that be applicable to us? I mean, we're exposed to sunlight every day.
It's coming through right now.
Yeah. I think it all depends on the guidelines that been given by a specific country, by their respective Ministry of Health.
Mm-hmm.
As I know, for instance, Canada are quite stringent in terms of their recommendations of vitamin D as a supplement. We don't have an exact, powerful recommendation coming from our, from our bodies, from our governments. But you know, there's a research coming. I think was published a couple of years ago that says that among general Malaysians, and this is a study that actually involved people who work in in a hospital in the close compound.
Right.
So they're not exposed to daily sunlight.
Too much sunlight.
So they found that about 80% of Malaysian women in this study and about 40% of Malaysian men actually have a lower than normal level of vitamin D.
Just like poor urologists get stuck in operating theatre.
So it doesn't mean that if you live in Malaysia, you have sunny day, all throughout the year, you are actually quite safe.
Yeah.
So if you have any concern, again, you can come and check it with your doctor.
Right.
We have a question from Andrew about a bypass. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Miss Lee, eh?
Yes.
Afternoon, Dr. George and Bernie, eh?
Yes.
Benny,
yeah. Actually, I'm a patient of eye exam. I did my bypass in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And I did ask some of the doctors there, what is the lifespan of the bypass? They told me average about 10 years.
Correct.
Right? If I don't take care of my diet properly or I don't exercise, the thing will go down to 5 years. I can only survive 5 years. Is it true?
Okay, great question. Okay, we'll answer that.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, again, it depends on the
depends on how much you don't take care, right? I mean, if you go and have 22 packets of cigarettes a day, I don't think it will last more than 5 years.
Yeah, but you're right. By average, people would quote a number of 10 years. But again, depends because, as I said earlier on in the program, sometimes we use arterial conduit from the chest, and sometimes they use vein. The artery conduit usually lasts longer than the veins.
Mm.
So there are a lot of factors
variables
that come into play.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But you would advise Andrew to eat well and live well, because it sounds I'm concerned for Andrew now.
Yeah.
Is it okay? I had the bypass now, so my batteries did recharge. Okay, right. So
yes.
How long will it recharge?
Yeah, I'm sorry to do this, Andrew, but I do hope you're eating well and exercising just for your sake. We have a question now from Robert. Good afternoon, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Hello, Dr. George.
Yeah.
Dr. Benny.
Hello.
Hi.
Dr. Benny.
Yes.
Yeah.
May I know what is double outlet ventricular? Is this a surgery available at IJM?
Double outlet ventricular.
If you're talking about a device, what we call an LVAD, well, it is a device that we use for people with a severe heart failure, basically end stage, who needs a transplant.
Mm.
Unfortunately, in some countries like Malaysia, we don't have a lot of donors.
Mm.
So we are left with no choice but to put this machine, devices. But it may not be what he meant. So it depends. LVAD is one of those technology that is available in Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
in IJN. It is usually put as basically a bridging, waiting for the donor to come up. However, if that is not available, sometimes we can use LVAD as what we call a destination therapy. That mm-hmm. means people can leave,
to buy some time.
Right. Or they can be put on LVAD for the rest of their life.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
We have a lot of questions from listeners, so we'll just try and get through as many of them as we can. WSDan88 from Twitter. How about vitamin C for prevention of heart attacks?
Okay.
Again, there's no real evidence to say. Most studies have shown that there is a link, but there is no obvious signal to say that it is, recommended as a treatment.
Right.
Yeah. So I think people need to be aware of the certain use of phrase that's been used when they read scientific article.
Right.
Some might use, a strong word such as it is a treatment, it is recommended.
Mm-hmm.
It has, as you said, an evidence-based medicine.
Yeah, that's
a strong meta-analysis.
Because it could be anecdotal and then it's described as stunning, or it could be something.
And some might use just a very weak word such as suggestive or, a link.
Like this study that looks at about 200 patients over a period of 6 months or something, which might be a bit meaningless whenever you look at long term.
Right. Because coming back to the vitamin D, there are multiple research I know out there that say that a reduced level of vitamin D is linked to cardiovascular disease.
All right.
But does supplementing it with vitamin D correct the problem? So that is another issue altogether.
Sure. Okay.
Right. We have Natalie on the line. Good afternoon, Natalie.
Hi, Natalie.
Natasha here, sorry.
Natasha.
Hi, Natasha.
Yeah, hi. My question is, how about far infrared and magnetic therapy?
Infrared and magnetic.
Far infrared.
Yeah.
Far infrared.
Right, and magnetic therapy. Okay, right. This is for the treatment of heart failure or for coronary artery?
Preventive.
All right, okay. Well, okay.
Thanks, Natalie. Yeah,
thanks for that. In prostate cancer and prostate prevention, we have all sorts of things like electromagnetic chairs and all sorts of things. Right. You know, Natasha, the problem about a lot of new technology is that it has to undergo the scrutiny of science and time. You know, and unfortunately, a lot of them are done with a small number and short interval. It's difficult to actually extrapolate any results from that. You know, some people might say it's good and some people might not. It will stand the test of time. I hope that answers the question.
Ong from Shah Alam, what are your thoughts about the micronutrient treatment promoted by Dr. Rath Mathias?
Oh, micronutrients. Now we're talking about like kind of like all these micronutrients.
Right.
You know, many people, these are kind of emerging in medicine, right? Mm. You know, it's kind of like GPs sometimes promote all these kind of anti-aging micronutrients, you know, trace minerals.
They call it alternative medicine.
So what's your view on that? When people turn up to IGN and come with all sorts of their figures like that, what do you say?
Yeah, first of all, I've never heard about this Dr. Rath Mathias before. Again, we have to be careful. There are a lot of people out there who have, you know, secondary gain out of promoting their product. They might...
Out of denouncing the pharmaceutical system, because that's what he does.
Correct.
This is
basically how they, you know, earn their, you know, their brand, you know.
Hopefully there is no kind of like financial incentive attached to the doctors. Right. And then that evidence will be a little bit more, you know, solid.
Even I've heard people who have used, you know, IGN as a name to say that IGN has promoted certain herbs or product, which I would strongly say here, we have never...
Yeah, never endorsed it.
Endorsed such products in our clinics.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
How risky is Wolf Parkinson disease?
Right. Would you like to explain? Wolf Parkinson's presumably is the...
Wolf Parkinson White, I think.
Wolf Parkinson White. It's just like, you know, my old days of medical school is the irregular heartbeat.
Yeah,
right?
As I said earlier, the heart disease has many, you know, aspects to it. Coronary artery disease, you know, valvular problems, structural problems. Wolf Parkinson White falls under the arrhythmia sort of condition. People who have Wolf Parkinson White, basically they have a short circuit inside their heart that enables the heart to deliver heartbeat faster than our normal people. Mm. So the heartbeat, you know, usual heartbeat would be 60 to 100, but people with WPW or Wolf Parkinson White probably have, you know, 150 to 200. Mm. So sometimes they may or may not realize that they have this. So sometimes what they have is a symptom of palpitation.
Right.
And if they have this, sometimes they will lead to giddiness.
Yeah.
They might lead to what we call fainting spell. And if it comes down to that, then they should come to the hospital. Because what in IGN we could do is to offer a procedure, what we call a radio frequency ablation.
Right.
To treat Wolf Parkinson White.
This is like what Tony Blair had, right? Yeah, did something he? Like that.
Wow.
I think so, yeah.
Okay,
we'll see how many more we can get through. We have almost no time.
Right.
What do you think of the supplement coenzyme Q10 for heart health? This is from Dan.
Right, okay. Many of my patients take Q10. Okay, any evidence at all?
Right, in general, it does help for people with heart
what
failure.
What is Q10?
Well, it's basically one of those antioxidative stress medicine that you can give. You know, I don't recommend it for a lot of people out there who is healthy. You know, of course, these supplements are quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would prescribe this coenzyme Q10 is for people with heart failure. So they may benefit from it. It's an antioxidative stress. And it relates to reducing inflammation at a cellular level.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thaya wants to know, my mom has been experiencing chest pain for about a year. She's gone to several doctors. Her last checkup was with IGN. Mm. Before that, the cardiologist prescribed her with GTN tablets. After her tests, results showed that she does not have heart disease, but they told her to use the GTN if pain occurs. Mm. Why would she have to do this if her test results don't show anything related to a heart disease?
Right, interesting. Some people may have vasospasm. Mm. Vasospasm meaning they don't have a coronary artery disease per se.
But coronary syndrome.
But sometimes the coronary artery will go into spasm mode. Usually they will benefit from other types of medicine called calcium channel blocker. But again, before we can say that this person have that, we need to, of course, do a certain type of test. The GTN, is actually what it is a vasodilator. So it helps in vasodilate the coronary artery. Again, usually I don't personally give GTN for people who don't have it. But in some people, they may have other things that would lead to the doctor to prescribe it.
Mm.
Yeah.
I've been on, let's see, aspirin taken long-term daily. Are there any effects on the kidneys? I'm on insulin and Cozaar as well in the last decade. Maha.
Okay. Right. Okay. Oh, my side is a kidney, right? Okay, right. Take too much of that. If you start bleeding in the urine, then there's a problem. So it does have to do, you know, have to actually titrate a little bit. And then, but long term, I don't believe. I mean, we have such long durations, exactly. Intervals of, you know, patients taking aspirin. Yeah. Really, it is more protective rather than harmful.
Yeah, I agree with you. Mostly people need to be aware of if there is any stomach ache, stomach pain, or they have maybe a black colored stool. Mm-hmm. That may be signs that they may have an internal sort of ulcer or bleeding.
Sure.
That need to be checked up.
Yeah.
Okay, I've officially run out of time. I can't even ask you guys for your final message. We have no time. And there was an interesting question about Dr. Mahathir. We have no time. But thank you both very much for coming in.
What a wonderful show.
Yes, thank you very much,
thank
Dr.
You,
Benny.
Thank you, Dr. Josh.
You've been listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.